Dr. Wilkinson and our distinguished guests of the Rocky Mountain Juvenile Court Institute, members of the faculty, and you, the most important part of this occasion, the students of Brigham Young University. I say most important because you are our future. Some of us here have had it. You are the ones who either are or about to be, and we impose great trust in you, with great reason for imposing that trust. The array of speakers, the parade of talent you have before you from week to week, is always frightening to anyone who follows in any order that parade which you have become so accustomed to. And this fact recalls to mind the observation that about the only way a bridegroom could attract attention would be to be absent from the ceremony. I think that's almost the only way I could have attracted any unusual attention here this morning, and I almost wish I had done it. Except for Dr. Wilkinson and Brother Anderson and Judge Paxman, who are so generous with your time and who induced me to come, I should not have been here. It's always a challenge to face this group. It's much easier to change audiences than it is to change speeches. Unfortunately, I find myself in the situation week after week on nationwide radio where I can't change audiences, so I have to change talks. One would think almost that he could come to Brigham Young University and repeat himself somewhat. Some of you won't remember what was previously said. Some of you, I suspect, are physically present and mentally absent, and if all of you were, this would be an easy task, but some of you do remember. There aren't any new plots in the world. There aren't any new principles. We all, of necessity, repeat ourselves a great deal. If we can just say things a little freshly, as to color, if not as to actual content, it's about the best we can expect from an occasion of this kind. I rarely prepare a formal talk, except for radio where scripts are called for. I have a conviction that there is a kind of contagion in the air each week and on each occasion, and hope and pray to catch a bit of that contagion. I think it was Bach who said that playing the piano is a relatively easy matter. It's just a matter of hitting the right notes at the right time. It's a little more than that, even. I've heard something more in the playing of the piano than merely hitting the right notes at the right time. There is something of the spirit that finds its way through the fingers of men and through the instrument that's even beyond the mere mechanics. And beyond what we say and the words we speak, if we can catch not only the right note at the right time, but the right spirit at the right time, we shall have justified our taking the time of an audience, even though we're somewhat limited as to specific things said. Now, in reaching for a theme to hang some few thoughts on this morning, I've found one that I can hang almost anything on. It's a quotation or a sentence from an unknown source. Human harvests are not just gathered in the autumn of life. They are planted, cultivated, and reaped each and every day. I should like to confine the remarks of the next very few minutes to that phrase which we might well call human harvest. That is the thing of which you have already heard here. I'm impressed with the principles under which this juvenile court system was established. As I understand it, it deals earnestly and sincerely with the spirit of the law as well as with the letter. And as you have already heard this morning, with the individual person. We've suffered some great losses in the church these past few months. Dr. Adam S. Bunyan, one of the beloved friends of my life, 40 years or more I have known him, 4.5 years I sat by his side many times each week. I remember his reporting of a comment of some parents who had reared a family of particularly choice children, one of whom he had interviewed for a mission. And he asked the mother and father how it was that they had been so successful in their very important task. And they gave him a simple sentence which implies much more than it says. The mother modestly said, "We always tried to know where they were." Sometimes I think in the years of youth we become a bit impatient with parents who sometimes want to know where we're going and with whom and what we're doing and all about our activities. There are many reasons why it should be so. First of all, they live through us. There's really no fun in having an operation unless you can tell someone about it. Or going on a trip unless you can come back and talk about it and bore your friends with pictures you've brought back. And coming back of an evening and talking to parents about experiences and sharing with them these things that so enliven our lives is a great safeguard in life as well as a great sharing and a great compensation. They're not going to go to the dance or to many of the places that we go, but sharing with them and having them always know where we are and coming back and reporting fully and being able in good conscience to report fully is one of the blessed things of life. The task of these able ladies and gentlemen of the juvenile court would be minimized, if not eliminated, if this were always so. Then there was Oscar Kirkham, whom we lost, a great champion of youth, a great understanding heart. As a fatherless boy, I remember him out in the hills 40 years ago with his penetrating, whispering voice, a husky quality that was unmistakable and distinctive. And I recalled at the General Conference two sentences that were found on his desk when he left this life. One was, "Your name is safe in our home." Think of it, profound in its simplicity. Your name is safe in our home. None of the backbiting or gossiping or irresponsible innuendo or accusation. A great understanding Christian heart. The other was, when any proposition was presented, "What will it do to the man? What will it do to the child? What will it do to the boy or the girl? What will it do to a life?" Regardless of the technicalities, and law has become exceedingly complex, I remember the statement of one of the great characters of medieval history, a little later than medieval, approaching the more modern, and I won't name him by name, but he said in substance about this, Give me 6 lines, 6 sentences, written by the most honorable of men, and I'll find enough in them to hang him. We can all misunderstand motives. We can all misinterpret intent. We can all find fault. And the fact that there are guarding the rights and the future of youth who find themselves making mistake, those who are somewhat concerned with intent, somewhat concerned not with the letter of the law only, but with the spirit of it, and are thinking, what will it do to the child? What will it do to the boy, to the girl, to the young man, to the young woman, is a source of some reassuring satisfaction. I brought with me, furthering this thought of human harvests, a few sentences from Emerson. I wish he were read more than he is these days. He has become less used and less referred to than in some decades of the past, and I commend him to your reading. This is from his great essay on compensation. He said, "What will you have?" quoth God. "Pay for it and take it. Thou shalt be paid exactly for what thou hast done, no more, no less. Everything has its price, and if that price is not paid, not that, but something else is obtained. It is impossible to get anything without its price. Men suffer all their life long under the foolish superstition that they can be cheated. But it is impossible for a man to be cheated by anyone but himself. Every virtue is rewarded, every wrong redressed. In silence and certainty." He wrote some other great thoughts on what he called the finishers in life. We all begin many good things and sometimes give them up too soon before we have followed through. It's true of all of us. I can think of many good resolutions of life. Resolutions to learn to play the piano, to learn a language, to learn to acquire skills, and a good many other things stopped before they were really given a fair opportunity to bear harvest, to bear fruit in our lives. And then he comments on the great percentage of people there are in the great cross-section of human beings, all endowed with a great plentiful supply of human nature, of those who are content just to get by. And in approximately his language, he speaks of those who do things as poorly as they dare. And then the small segment, or relatively small segment, of those who work for the love of working and who study for the love of studying and who seek great ultimate accomplishment and the acquisition and development of great gifts. It's the difference between the D and C students and the A students in an academic institution sometimes. Just doing enough to get by isn't enough in life. It impoverishes life. It impoverishes us. It impoverishes all around us. In speaking of human harvests, we ought always to resolve to be found among the finishers. Those who point to some good and great objective and then follow through and pay the price. It was recently reported at a conclave of educators of the higher echelons of learning that 44% of entering freshmen in colleges in the United States graduate. 44%, a casualty or a mortality of 56% of those who begin this good thing of a college career. That only 35% of those entering state universities graduate, a mortality of 65%. The beginnings of things are important, as also is the following through. Now I'm going to pass by much of what I had brought with me. Most of it, as a matter of fact, and turn to, in closing this thought on human harvests, a phase of it which I feel would tie into the work of those who are our guests here this morning, as well as all others of us. I should like to begin it with a choice statement from President McKay. When God becomes the center of our lives, we lose self. We forget self. If we could get that thought over to our young people, when temptation comes to them, it would be sufficient to preserve them from temptation. Instead of thinking of themselves in the hour of temptation, if they would just forget self and think of mother and of father, of the good name of the family, and just lose themselves a moment for somebody else, they would have the power to resist temptation. 3 or 4 weeks ago, I used on the air a series that is for 2 or 3 weeks consecutively, successively, used the theme of friendship and some of the tests of it and some of the meanings of friendship, and closed this series of 3 or 4 weeks with one which some of you have heard, but which I make no apology for repeating, which I call the test of intent, and of the fact that no true friend would ever lead us into temptation or to the making of memories that we would later be less than thankful for. With these thoughts recalled, we have come to the conclusion that one sure test of friendship is to seek the welfare of him whose company we keep. Since this is so, a reasonable question to ask of everyone is this: what do you intend? Do you intend to succeed? Do you intend to live righteously? Do you intend to keep the commandments? Do you intend to seek the welfare of friends? Do you intend to finish the good things you've started? What do you intend? The inner intent of the hearts of men is a matter of surpassing importance. Do they intend good or evil? Honesty or dishonesty? Sincerity or deception? Do they intend to serve and to safeguard others, or do they intend selfish self-service, selfish self-indulgence at the expense of others? At a time now sometimes called Victorian and sometimes referred to as old-fashioned, fathers inquired concerning the intentions of those with whom their daughters kept company. And whatever way we may call it, old-fashioned or otherwise, we cannot safely fail to consider the motives of men. The motives of everyone are important. The intent of the heart is important. It is the blueprint of what will likely be built. It is what a man will likely do if he can, when he can. Intent is the desire that leads to the doing of the deed. For some well-known words as to intent, we turn to Proverbs. Eat thou not the bread of him that hath an evil eye, neither desire thou his dainty meats. For as he thinketh in his heart, so is he. Eat and drink, saith he to thee, but his heart is not with thee. We must look to the motives of men. We must look to their real intent. And while some may say old-fashioned and some contend that times have changed, the nature of men has not, nor has God, nor have the commandments we must keep if we are to preserve honor and honesty, virtue and chastity, cleanliness and self-respect, and happiness and peace inside ourselves, which, by all the experience of all the ages, are paramount among things most precious to be preserved. It is never wise to yield a principle to save a supposed friendship, to save an association, and anyone who does is either deceiving or is deceived. No matter what date the calendar has turned to, even in such a time as the 20th century, it is still essential to know the nature and motives of men and to safeguard the most precious and irreplaceable things. For with all our modern talk and so-called modern emancipation, we haven't left behind the commandments of God, nor the consequences of not keeping them. There is so much more that might be said, but I feel sure this will suffice to conclude the theme of human harvests. There's no magic about it. We live the law and reap the reward. We make the effort and acquire the skill or the talent. We do the studying and acquire the knowledge. Or we fail and sometimes fall short of what we might have been or might have done or could have accomplished. God bless you, my beloved young friends, to examine the intent of your hearts, to resolve to succeed, and to find that joyous, everlasting happiness and limitless peace and progress, which is far part of our Father's plan and purpose for the children that He loves, in the keeping of the commandments and in the living of the law. I pray in Jesus' name, amen.